Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 7. The Verb System, Part 1.
This is the start of 3 lectures on the verb system in English. And before you think, oh my gosh, I'm going to fast forward, this is the heart of so many grammatical difficulties. And if you understand the verb system, so many other things will fall into place. I also have to tell you, when I was writing this course, at first I thought I would have one lecture on the verb system, just like I had one on the noun pronoun system. And then it kept getting longer and getting longer. It was really frustrating. I was trying to cram it in. And finally I said, heck with it, 2 lectures on the verb system. And then it kept getting longer and longer and longer. Finally, 3 lectures on the verb system. But when we're done, it is all going to come together in place like this beautiful puzzle. And just to set up where it's going to go, first we're going to set up the regular verb system. Then we're going to go to talk about verbals, which are where we find out about our split infinitives and our dangling participles. And finally, we're going to get to the highly irregular verbs of am, is, are, was, and were, and all of that stuff. So these are the 3 lectures. We start off with the basics, and we build out complexity. Now, the verb system in English is complicated. I will not lie. But it is a lot less complicated than many other languages, if that makes you feel any better. It's my experience that the verb system is the site of a lot of angst about English, though people don't always recognize that they're worried about the verb system. They think more it's something general like grammar, or I just don't understand how this works. But the one reason is that when we teach the verb system in 7th and 8th grade grammar, we immediately dive into this kind of hellish soup of nomenclature, of names and descriptions. So we have the past perfect and the present participle and the pluperfect, and nobody remembers what any of that stuff is. So we're not going to do that. Or we will build up some of those old school rules, but we're going to approach the verb system as exactly that, a system. As a set of logic that explains how to put things together. We're going to find out how it works. And then all those terms from 8th grade grammar that got me low quiz scores in 8th grade will all start to make sense. And I have to say this, you know, I'm a professional grammarian. I'm an English professor. And I got piles of C minuses, and as I'll tell you later, even worse grades, in junior high school English. So it's simply a matter of how the things are taught, I think, and how to understand them. Now, the big reason that the English verb system is complex is the reason that most things in English that are complex. And that's the history of the language. Parts of the verb system are still as they were in the distant Indo-European past, 20, 30,000 years ago. Other big chunks are the same as in the Anglo-Saxon period. But yet other pieces are post-Norman conquest and more recent. So we have, as we described before, that kind of complex layering of different systems. We never erased the first system before we came up with the second or the third. For example, in Proto-Indo-European, so way back 30,000 years ago, when people were still living in mud huts in the south of Russia and so forth, verbs indicated past tense through apophony or gradation, which is called in German, Ablaut. Now, before I lose you, let me say that this is actually very straightforward if you've learned English already. And if you haven't learned at least some English, I don't know how you're listening to me, so I'm not going to worry too much about this. We still have apophony, gradation, or Ablaut in modern English with things like ring, rang, and rung, bring and brought, run and ran, swim, swam, dive, dove, sing, sang, sung, take, took, and so forth. Ooh, maybe I should just recite verbs that Drought likes. That could be fun. We could pair it with nouns that Drought likes and Drought's favorite prepositions. Email recorded books and tell them that's what you want. Now, in Anglo-Saxon, these verbs that use ablaut or that use apophony, gradation, the same thing, ring, rang, rung, are called strong verbs. I always think of them as these verbs, strong like bull. They change in the middle. They don't change on end. But they're called strong verbs. And you can tell that it was some, you know, 19th century German philologist who was like, these verbs are more like German. They will be strong. And the other ones are just weak and wimpy verbs. But these create what people, I think, mistakenly call irregular verbs. So we have our regular verbs and then we have our irregular verbs. Don't follow that. We're going to call them strong verbs. and regular verbs. The traditional would be to say strong and weak, but I don't really want to get into that. Now, the regular verbs, the weak verbs, okay, I have to use the terminology a little bit, don't change their vowels like ring, rang, rung. Instead, they take an ending to stick on the end. And it should be pretty familiar to modern English speakers. It's a D or a T sound at the end of the verb. And we call this a dental preterite. Yes, I am proliferating jargon, but it's going to come up so many times. I'm just going to tell you dental preterite. Why is it called that? Well, it doesn't have anything to do with dentistry, but it has something to do with your teeth. It's a sound that's made with the tongue touching the back of the teeth. So say tuh or duh. You'll see your tongue is touching the roof of your mouth just behind your teeth. It's called a dental preterite, and it's the T or D that turns the verb into a past tense. We're going to meet dental preterite again and again and again. So remember that. So we have these two separate verb systems working in English. Over time, the strong verb system, the ring, rang, rung, has gotten less frequent, and the regular dental preterite system has taken over. English is very slowly, but pretty rapidly as language change goes, converting strong verbs to weak verbs, changing the ring, rang, rung to the walk, walked paradigm. And we rarely add strong verbs. One of the only recent additions of strong verbs, and it wasn't all that recent at all, is adding snuck to go as the past tense of sneak. That's actually not back in the Anglo-Saxon period. That's much, much later. And I've actually found one or two old grammar books. Yes, I read old grammar books that said that snuck is inappropriate. It's low class. It's not the right way to say it. You say sneak and sneaked. That's how slowly change occurs, because snuck seems completely normal to us. It's also possible in the next 500 years, as English becomes more of a world language, that we're going to lose even more strong verbs. For example, bake used to be a strong verb, just like take. Now we say take took, but we don't say bake book. But it used to be a strong verb. So we can once again blame the history of English for the difficulties of English grammar. Old verb system, strong verb system working, and we don't get rid of it, but we add in a new verb system that allows us more easily to add verbs. Why? Because not all verbs will work very well with that vowel change. What would you change walk to? Walk, wake, or something? There might be something in Proto-Germanic to do that, but not in English. We just don't follow apophony vowel gradation anymore. So that's the history behind it. Then let's look at how the system works itself. Verbs have to communicate all kinds of information. They tell us things about the noun that is linked to the verb. They tell us when the action is happening in terms of time, whether or not the action is complete or ongoing, and if the action has really happened or we're just imagining it. And unfortunately, many of these bits of information are interlinked, and that leads to even more additional complexities. So let's just start out with the basics. Verbs vary depending on person, number, tense, and mood. There are three persons in English grammar, and this is really easy to keep track of if you imagine them as a little gathering. This is seriously what I do. Picture a street corner, and a person walks up, and it's you or me. One person standing there. They are the first person on the street corner. If that person talks, if you're the person, you would say I, because you're not going to say you about yourself, and you're not going to say anything in plural. So the first person is I. A second person shows up. That's why it's called the second person. And I speaks to you. So you is the second person. Then a third person shows up, and exactly they're the third person. So I says to you, he is over there. Third person. Again, this sounds complicated, but if you close your eyes and think of it, well, don't do this if you're driving right now, but if you think of it, you can imagine the first person, second person, third person. And then to press the metaphor, if two people are on the corner, they can be we, another two people come up, they can still be you, another two come up, and they can be they. Now, the idea of number, as you can tell from that, gets quickly mixed in with the persons. In English, we only have two numbers. Yay! Finally, something that's simple. We have singular and plural, one and more than one. This is, by the way, not the case in all languages. Old English had a singular, a plural, and a dual, which was exactly two. So you'd have one person, exactly two people, and any more than two. And other languages can make different distinctions. But pretty simple, right? Singular, plural. Easy. And then we have tense, which in English can be past, present, or future. Now, Old English did not have a future tense, hence the mildly bitter Anglo-Saxonist joke, Old English, there's no future in it. But the language got by anyway without a future tense. In fact, the legacy of Anglo-Saxon's lack of a future tense is that the future tense in modern English isn't actually communicated by the verb itself, but by additional words that we stick into the sentence. We will, that's one of those words, will. We will go over this at a later time, see, future tense. That's in a moment. Anglo-Saxon, you wouldn't have been able to do that. You wouldn't have been able to say will. You would have to have some kind of more complex way of getting around it. And this isn't a course in Anglo-Saxon, so I'll let that slide. But we should be thankful here also that we're studying English grammar, because other languages have a much more complicated tense system, with not just past, present, and future, but all kinds of other little gradations of that. But we're not going to deal with that either. So let's put these elements of the verb system together. We only bother to distinguish between number with verbs in the present tense, and only in the third person. So let's take the verb walk. I walk. We walk. You walk, you walk. That's singular, plural you. We've already talked about why that's a problem. He walks, she walks, it walks, they walk. I walked, we walked. You walked, you walked, he walked, she walked, it walked. Sounds like a Dr. Seuss thing you could put together. But this is actually conjugating the verb, what we just did, which is to list out all the possible tenses and all the possible numbers. We haven't done future because we're going to need an auxiliary verb for that, and I'm holding off on that. But we also did the two tenses, present and past. So we notice that there's just two distinctions to make. In the past tense, we added that ED ending. This is our old friend, the dental preterite, which I told you to remember. In the present tense, we are only concerned about the third person. We don't care about the other persons. They're all the same. By the way, it's even a little simpler when we get away from pronouns in the third person, like he, she, and it, and go on to regular old nouns. We say the dog walks, the dogs walk. The cow moos, the cows moo. The red panda sleeps, the red pandas sleep. I want to call this the conservation of S law. Again, if you're a native speaker, this is probably not too difficult. It probably isn't difficult at all. But if you're learning English as a second language, or if you want to see how it works analytically, then conservation of S helps. What conservation of S says is you only need one S between the subject and the verb. If you have an S at the end of the subject because it's plural, then you don't put it on the verb. And if you don't have it on the subject, then you do put it on the verb. And the history behind that is pretty complex, but the basic idea is that English was weeding out redundancy in some places, so you wouldn't have multiple plurals there. Unfortunately, for those who are learning English as a second language, it makes a big difference where that S goes, the noun or the verb. So while we have the conservation of S, that doesn't tell you where to put it. Native speakers, you get a free pass on this one because that comes pretty easily. One other quick point about the plural in English verbs. It only applies to the subject, not to the verb itself, as it does in many other languages. So if we say red pandas nap or cows moo, all we're talking about is the number of pandas or the number of cows. We're not talking about the number of naps or the number of moos. Other languages make a difference. So the verb will indicate whether the action was done once, twice, multiple times. We convey some of this information through auxiliary verbs, which we'll get to. But the verb itself doesn't change based on the number of moos or the number of naps. So that makes things a little easier for when we're parsing out English. So we've got person, number, and tense. If we stopped here, the English verb system would be pretty easy. All you'd have to remember would be the dental preterite, that's the ED, and the conservation of S in the third person present tense. And those two simple rules will handle an awful lot of English sentences. But they don't cover everything we might ever want to know about a verb. And they don't cover the verbs that don't follow these rules. And that includes some pretty common and important verbs like is. We first need to add one more category to our basic qualities of verbs, and that is mood. Happy verbs, depressed verbs, verbs that laugh at everything and don't know why. Just kidding. Mood is here used as a technical term. It's unfortunate that it has another meaning, but at least we're not proliferating jargon. We have three moods in English: the indicative, the imperative, and the subjunctive. The indicative is really just what it sounds like. You are indicating something. You are explaining something about the world by using the verb. This is just our regular garden variety form of the verb. So, kids walked on my lawn is the indicative. Just tells about that something happened. It's really the fundamental level. Then we get the imperative, and that's a command. I always think imperative is related to emperor, so that you know why they're commanding. It's because the emperor is the one who commands. The imperative mood is a command. Now, it can only be used in English in the second person. It's probably because you can't command yourself. I mean, you just do the thing rather than command yourself. So that's why it's not in the first person. And if you're talking about a command in the third person, you're really just describing it, and that makes it indicative. If you say, "I want you kids off my lawn," you're just describing something. You're describing what you want. You're actually still not telling the kids grammatically to get off your lawn. I should point out that the social function of the sentence, "I want you kids off my lawn," is very separate from the grammar. The social function is a command. The imperative is usually marked by not using a subject in the sentence. This is the famous understood you that we were taught in seventh grade. There's an understood you there. Okay, there's an understood you there, but a simpler way of saying is the way English makes an imperative is to delete the you. So, "Get off my lawn!" is in the imperative. There's no subject. You go right to the verb, "Get off my lawn." But you can use the second person still for emphasis. "You, get off my lawn!" You'll notice that the imperative also has to be the present tense. You can't command someone in the past tense and say, "Got off my lawn!" Because think if we could command people in the past tense, it would create a mess. It wouldn't make any sense. So we've got the indicative mood and the imperative mood. And now we go into the depths of hell, the subjunctive. The subjunctive is much more complicated, but we can be thankful that it is nowhere near as complicated in English as it is in other languages, Spanish. The subjunctive in modern English is used for things that have not yet happened, but aren't truly in the future. That is, they have not occurred, they might not occur, but we're not saying that they will occur in the future. This is really confusing. And one of the reasons why is because Old English had a subjunctive and didn't have a future tense, and the evolution of the language has created a bit of a mess. So if you say something like, "I might go to the store," "I could have gone to the store," "I should have gone to the store," "I wish I had gone to the store," you're using the subjunctive. That's what subjunctive is. Don't go back to your old Latin thing where subjunctive is contrary to fact. It doesn't have to be contrary to fact. It's things that haven't really happened and that you're not completely predicting will happen either. This is challenging, but it's the best way I can find to describe it. Now, you'll notice that the verbs in those sentences really didn't change. The verbs themselves, "gone to the store," "gone to the store," "go to the store," just present and past, they're basically the same. But we put additional verbs in right before them to indicate the subjunctive. And these are called the modals. Coulda, woulda, shoulda. We'll discuss those more in a second. But there is one word in which the verb itself changes in the subjunctive. One in English. And as this is connected to some really common grammar anxieties, I'm going to go over it here. We say, "If I were you, I'd go to the store right now." Did you ever stop to think that this form makes no sense whatsoever? I were. The verb does not agree with the subject. We don't say, "I were at the store," or "I were going." So why do we say, "If I were you"? We seem to be mixing up the singular and the plural. Why? Well, of course, as the answer has been throughout the course, history is the reason why. It turns out that the "were" in "if I were you" is the last remnant of the Anglo-Saxon subjunctive, which is just lurking around in this one phrase. Generally, Anglo-Saxon made the subjunctive by taking an ending that was usually an and changing it to en. So anytime you would regularly have an a sound towards the end of a word, you'd put an e there. That's completely gone. It isn't anywhere in modern English. But with the irregular verb "was," there was a word, "waron," which was the subjunctive form. And that we have kept around for that phrase, if I were you. Entirely confusing. Now, I know some people who get really, really worked up about whether they should say, if I were you, or if I was you, because if I were you sounds pretentious, and if I was you sounds wrong. Now, one of my students, when I was talking about this, I just asked them, so what do you think about the phrase, if I was you? Student said, oh, well, that sounds really low class and ignorant. That was great, because I'm from New Jersey, and where we say, if I was you, frequently in informal speech, so I was very happy to say, oh, well, I guess I'm low class and ignorant then. Make the poor students sweat. No, seriously, let's explain why this works this way. Now, this is a good example of the kind of balancing act we play between using elite and, quote, proper forms and using dialect or regular forms, and the difference between kind of solidarity with the people we're from and being part of the elite. So if you are the kind of person who thinks, if I were you, sounds pretentious, that's because you're identifying it with elite speech. And if you think, if I was you, sounds ignorant, you're identifying it with dialect speech. And you're right in certain senses, but you can see that it's an irrationality in the midst of English. Why are we saying, if I were you? History. Now, I don't advise you to start saying, if I was you, because then people will think you're from New Jersey, which I happen to think is a great compliment, but not everyone does. But you now know why we say, if I were you. And the reason is that we don't have a helping verb in that sentence. We don't have might, would, was, or something like that to indicate that it's subjunctive. We have to do it somehow, and we do it by changing the verb itself from was to were. Okay, that covers the way the regular verbs work, and that's the majority of verbs in English, though it's not a huge majority because of what we're going to talk about in a moment. But there are, of course, the other types. And as I've already said once, we lump these together as irregular verbs, and I think that's a mistake. Irregular verbs for me are do, have, go, is, and a few others. Then we have two categories of regular verbs, the weak verbs or the plain old regular verbs, which you just talked about. And now what we'll talk about here, the strong verbs. Remember that strong verbs, the verb is strong like bull, can stand by itself, changes a vowel in the stem to indicate a past tense. And this feature, apophony, vowel gradation, ablaut, goes way back to Proto-Indo-European. Let's do a strong verb paradigm, and you'll see exactly what I mean. I run, and we run. You run, you run. He runs, she runs, it runs. So far, so good. I ran, we ran. You ran, you ran. He ran, she ran, it ran. So you'll notice that the present tense, it's just like a regular verb. There's even the conservation of S rule in effect for the third person, right? We have we run, I run, you run, he runs. So present tense, no problem. In the past tense, we change the vowel, and following a rule of vowel gradation or ablaut, we go from run to ran. Now, there's a decent number of strong verbs, and now I will list a few. See, we can get verbs, drought legs. We could make a whole CD of it. Maybe we could put a dance beat. It would be the Macarena of 2009. So let me just give you the main classes of the strong verbs. Bite, bit, fly, flew, spring, sprang, give, gave, take, took, fall, fell, bring, and brought. There are many, many more, but those are the basic major ablaut rows, we might call them, or groups, or apophony groups, whatever you want to call it. They fall into basic groups depending on what their vowels are. And if this were a class on philology, or historical linguistics, or even history of the English language, we would look in more detail at each vowel gradation individually. And really, I have to say here that this is where we separate the men from the boys, or the women from the girls, or the sheep from the lambs, or something like that in philology. Philologists say, oh, anybody can learn consonant changes, but it's the real philologists who understand their vowel changes. And really what that means is that philologists will look at all the specific changes of vowels and use that for things like figuring out when the language changed, what the antecedent of a word is, what the history of a word is, and it's all based on the vowels. However, that's going a little bit beyond what we need for this course. Especially because if I'm sitting here reciting vowels for the next hour or so, which is what it would take to get through all of them, everyone will fall asleep. So instead, we're going to find a decent, not perfect, but decent rule of thumb that says if you know one strong verb, you can figure out others by finding verbs that rhyme with it. So if you have bite and bit, and fly and flew, and spring and sprang, you can find other verbs that rhyme. So spring sprang, ring rang, sing sang, hey, they all have the same kind of vowel gradation. Now, it doesn't work for bake, book, no, even though it works for take, took, and it doesn't work for bring, brang, instead of ring, rang, but it works for a lot of words. And so if, again, your English is a second language and you are learning this, think, oh, well, strong verbs, if they rhyme, I can figure out what the past tense is. Now, I know somewhere listening to this, some German philologist is smacking himself on the forehead and saying, no, no, Drat, we don't simplify so much. But why is a German philologist even listening to my course on English grammar, I wonder? I wonder. And why is he not speaking in German when he says this? But anyway, I don't think I'm oversimplifying too much, or I don't think I'm oversimplifying. One thing about learning English as a second language is that you just have to kind of commit to memorizing a fair number of words. I mean, there's no other way about it. Anytime you learn a foreign language, if you're English, learning Spanish or Japanese, you just have to memorize words. And the strong verbs are among those that you really just have to memorize. So you can guess sing sang from spring sprang, but it doesn't work with bring and brang. You'll sound like you're from Appalachia or somewhere non-standard if you say bring brang. Now, by the way, one little side thing, we have ring and rang and spring and sprang, but I didn't mention the last bit. We have ring, rang, and rung. I will ring you. Yesterday, I rang you. Thorin had rung the doorbell twice. That third one, the rung, is the participle, which we're going to talk about really soon in the next lecture. But I need you to just remember right now that strong verbs actually have three principal parts. They're called three layers of gradation for the vowel gradation. So ring, rang, and rung, spring, sprang, and sprung. That third one is the past participle. We'll remember that later, especially because it's important because participial forms of other verbs are created in a much simpler fashion. We add ing or ed and we're done. But the strong verbs in modern English created the participle by changing that vowel. Now, don't worry, I'm just bringing up participles. I'll give you their full glorious treatment in the next lecture. But I just want you to remember, because we're going to be using it, the past participle of a strong verb is also created by additional vowel gradation. Again, strong verbs, pain if you're coming to English as a second language, not so bad for native speakers. However, there are some exceptions, and as this ties in with one of our larger themes about the drought way of grammar, I'm going to bring it up here. Certain non-standard dialects in modern English, including sometimes the English spoken in rural areas of America and African-American English, sometimes use strong verbs where modern English has used a weak verb. So bring brang is not quite that process because we do have bring and brought, but to say brang as the past tense is non-standard. It's a strong verb paradigm, and it's still used in non-standard English. Or to use weak verbs where English uses strong verbs. So, for example, to say fall and falled rather than fall and fell, or take and taked. This is a standard non-standard thing, I should say. It shows up all the time. It shows up in English in lots of different places, and that's what's going on. Other times, we create strong verbs for effect. So we get woke and boke, being the past tense of wake and bake, though this is drug-related humor and may be as much of a joke and deliberate invention rather than an old form as anything else. Now, we'll discuss these issues more, but I want to point out then that the problem is not so much that people don't understand the grammar or don't understand the grammatical subtleties, as instead that they're following a different set of conventions. Now, they may be doing this deliberately, like in woke and boke, or they may be doing it and not knowing that there is another convention because they've grown up in one particular dialect form. But it's not ungrammatical. Not in the sense that a linguist would look at it and say, oh, well, that makes no sense. And in fact, you understand what the person's talking about. This is not to say that you can talk non-standard English and not have people look down at you. But just to point out here that you're following the same rules. By the way, little kids do this when they learn English, and they do what's called overgeneralization. So they either won't know the strong form, or they'll apply the strong verb change where it doesn't belong. Okay, so now we have the basics of the verb system down, and even the complexities of the strong verbs, which some people call irregular but which are not. Now we're ready to move on to the really difficult verby stuff, the truly irregular verbs, but first, the different kinds of auxiliaries, which we also call helping verbs, and the verbals, the verb-like entities. You're going to finally learn what a participle is, why we shouldn't let it dangle, and why people get so irate over split infinitives.
This ends Lecture 7.